Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you through the studios of KHOI Community Radio. Well, so, Donna, have you been listening to the Winter Olympics?
No.
Oh, okay.
I read the headlines in the paper. That's about it.
That's right. Yeah. I like to watch some of the stuff with the sound off because it's just a bit too much. Although the figure skating is always lovely. Yes, it always is. And I don't know how
music, right?
The music is good. No, I do listen to that. That's good. And boy, that people are doing just the most amazing things over there. But don't think that China has got the last word on winter sports. No, siree. Right here in Iowa, last weekend was the 45th annual Bike Ride to Rippy. That is the acronym of BRR, B-R-R, BRR, the Bike Ride to Rippy. And they've been doing that for 45 years. And, of course, the coldest day of the year, although this year I guess it wasn't as bad as it's been in the past. Rippy, Iowa. The bicycle.
This is like the miniature rag ride.
Yeah. Okay. 24 miles. They start from the Hotel Patti in Perry, and go, well, the whole route is 24 miles to Perry and from Perry to Rippy and back. And about.
And back.
Yeah, because the beer and the hot chocolate is at the hotel.
Oh, at the hotel pad.
Yeah. Okay. So I would too. But they had they said about 600 people showed up, which is better than other years.
600. Whoa.
That's what it said. Well, yeah. Who would have thought? But people have done it for many years. And so we are a hardy lot here.
I suppose they have those fat snow tires on this.
Yeah, or something. Yeah. I think it was kind of windy, but it wasn't as bad. Well, actually, that's a very Iowa way to looking at it. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. Yeah. Okay. A good time was had by all. Huh? So Valentine's Day just around the corner. Today we'll talk about some treats, but first, here is an update from Donna.
Yeah, we have going to throw in a little more USDA news here. So if you remember a few weeks ago, there was a Joe Biden, Secretary Vilsack, and Merrick Garland announcement about giving more money in support of small meat processors and lockers and going after kind of trust busting, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, boy, we're going to step right up here and fix it. So that left us with a lot of, not that it shouldn't be done because it should, but the question is really how to do it and what are they going to do? So Gail Hickenbottom, who's a wonderful, kind listener of ours, I must say, I always enjoy, sometimes he writes to me and tells me what he thinks. He sent me a very interesting article from something called the Mises Institute, which I am not familiar with, but it made sense. He was reminding me, and he was correct, that actually the reason we don't have small meat processors is because of some federal legislation about 40 or 60 years ago, which kind of busted and set us up for the whole thing. So this article says the Wholesome Meat Act of 1967 mandates meat must be slaughtered and processed at a federally inspected slaughterhouse or a facility inspected in a state with meat inspection laws at least as strict as the federal requirements. Small processors found it difficult, if not impossible, to meet the federal requirements. Obviously, needed lots of equipment updates and infrastructure, expensive stuff. So the cost was simply too high. Of course, large corporations can bear regulatory costs. As a result, the meat processing industry went through massive consolidation after the inaction of this act. Remember, this is 1967. Since the passage of the Wholesome Meat Act, the number of slaughterhouses dropped from more than 10,000 to 2,766 in 2019. Today, instead of hundreds of companies processing meat, three corporations control virtually the entire industry. So, yes, this is correct. And thank you, Gail, for pointing this out because, you know, now the Fed's done it in 1967 with, I'm sure, the backing of large industries, because of course they knew that, you know, only the big guys can, and this happened in the dairy industry as well. I mean, I have to say my dairy farming uncles also went out of business in that time because the updated milk standards, they were 50 cow farms, and they just couldn't afford to make the changes. So, a little background on that. So the Fed's done broke it. Now the Fed's going to fix it. So, but the question is, how are they going to fix it? Now, an interesting comment that I wanted to talk about was Kathleen Merrigan wrote a little open letter to Secretary. Well, I'm going to tell you.
Oh, okay.
Kathleen Merrigan wrote an interesting letter to Vilsack about this. So Kathleen is a good person to talk to Secretary Vilsack about this because she was his deputy undersecretary, deputy secretary of agriculture during his last go round. And she actually is a longtime acquaintance, and I love to follow what Kathleen does because she's really, really smart, and I always agree with her. So anyway, she is, she was around and, you know, was part of the writing of the original organic standards, and she's now is the director of something called the SWEET, SWEETE or something like that. At Arizona State. Yes, the SWEETE. Sweet Center for Sustainable Food, or it might be SWEAT. I don't know. Anyway, so she's continuing her work there. And she sent a note saying, a few areas where we see an urgent need for investment in research and infrastructure and development are listed below. So, you know, of course, their announcements were suitably vague, but Kathleen's ready to nail it. She says, opportunities for tribal nations. Now, since she's in Arizona, she's probably very much more aware of that because she had been East Coast based for a long time. And she says, we recommend that the USDA direct funds to tribal nations for meat processing facilities. A really, really good idea because a lot of it is on land that is suitable for grazing and bison raising and all of that sort of thing. The second point she brings up is, grass-fed beef represents a small portion of the beef consumed in the U.S., but it is one of the fastest-growing meat categories. Grass-fed beef is often more nutrient-rich option when compared to conventional grain. It also has a lower, possibly negative carbon footprint. She didn't go into that. But so it needs a different kind of handling and aging process. So small processors are better at dealing with that. So she recommends that the USDA dedicate funds on research towards grass-fed beef processing, as well as toward a grading system that would increase grass-fed beef's marketability and consumer access. Then number three, she mentions, and this is a little complicated, but she says communication and coordination is extremely important when linking the farmers to processors to grocery and retail outlets. Now, this is the whole crux of the whole conundrum for local food producers. Like if a farmer wants to grow a small herd of, say, grass-fed beef or regular, even conventional beef, whatever, and they don't want to dump it into the market process where they have very little price control, even if they want a direct market or if they want to process it and then sell it to a local grocery store. It's complicated and it's kind of like reinventing the wheel one farmer at a time. So she's suggesting the USDA to allocate a portion of these funds on communication and coordination models that can address challenges faced by small scale farmers and meat processors. This also affects organic processors too, because if you are selling organic meat, it must be processed in a facility that has certain requirements that the big producers don't often have. So she suggested that was, and then she said, the other one was community-based innovation models. that's also complicated of the more of how to buy, you know, local foods. The USDA should focus a portion of these funds on investigating and promoting innovative community-based models of meat processing. So anyway, she's put some more details out there for Secretary Vilsack to think about. So thank you, Kathleen. The other thing I saw just this morning, new USDA announcement yesterday. Okay. This one is really vague. Now, maybe there'll be more details, but this is the quick and dirty announcement was $1 billion is going to be invested into, quote, climate smart pilot projects.
Climate smart projects
to help farmers develop a market for sustainably produced commodities. So that kind of sounds a little bit like what Kathleen was saying in her second two recommendations. She also mentioned that there is a group called the Niche Meat Processors Assistant Network, which has done a lot of research on this. Now, I have to very proudly let you know that when my son, Arian Tubumri, was studying in rural sociology at ISU, he was really instrumental in creating this group because he saw when he came to Iowa that, you know, we've lost this infrastructure. So he did a lot of work on that. And the organization has just blossomed to be very helpful to farmers. So, so anyway, yesterday they made this announcement that they're going to give another $1 billion to research, climate smart pilot projects to develop the sustainably produced commodities market, whatever all that means. But here's the hitch. The 2023 Farm Bill is coming up after our next election. And so funding for climate mitigation is not certain because we don't know, you know, although some Republicans, I mean, we're assuming that they'll have greater say in what's going on. Maybe, maybe not. We still don't know. But, you know, the question is, will the next elected group of people who are allowing funding for the USDA, will they be really focusing on climate change? Who knows? So maybe the Biden administration is trying to get that billion out the door before that happens, or in case we take a step backwards, who knows? Anyway, that's my latest news from what's going on with the government.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
All right.
It does affect us eventually.
It does. It does.
Yeah, but like with the 1967 Food Act or whenever that was, that's 50 some years ago, and it took that long to break the whole thing or for us to recognize that it was broken, right?
And like you say, let's
think. You got to think a little bit ahead of yourself, you know, if you're running a government this big. Oh,
well, Donna, let's get back to Valentine's Day. I mean, that's not a very good segue, but there it is.
Yeah, something a little more pleasing.
Yeah. Yeah. So here are some tasty ideas. Meringues, cream puffs, all that kind of stuff. But first, a little news item here. M&M's, believe it or not, are the state of Iowa's favorite Valentine's Day candy, according to a e-commerce platform called candystore.com, of course.
They would know, right? Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, M&M's are really big here in Iowa, according to sales and all that kind of stuff. And we prefer M&M's, chocolate in many forms, but M&M's over those chalky conversation hearts, which is good. I mean, they're cute, but they don't
taste nearly, there's no chocolate in them.
No, okay. They're cute, but for some reason, one of our neighbors, Nebraska's favorite Valentine's Day candy is something called Cupid Corn, which is a pink version of Halloween candy corn.
Oh, thank goodness we don't have that in Iowa.
Oh, my. There you go. And, okay, 47% of people say they will buy themselves a box of chocolates this year. Maybe they'll share it with somebody. And Americans buy around 58 million pounds of chocolate during Valentine's Day week. Oh.
Well, but, you know, if you want to avoid all the commercial claptrap, it's a good time to be making some sweets, and we have some suggestions for you.
Oh, very good. We've got Donna's going to help give us some techniques and recipes for meringues, cream puffs, pavlovas, macaroons. I don't know. Things start good here. I think we're going to get into the magic of egg whites. Take it away, Donna.
Using eggs for all these desserts. I guess I got on a little thing with eggs this week. It started with meringues. Okay. This was a huge hit. We're going to keep repeating this one. So it's from, I have a couple of recipes from Alice Medridge, who I think is just, she ran a Berkeley, California, or still probably does, called Chocolate. So she is the voice on chocolate. So, she has a recipe for chocolate meringue. So I decided I wanted to, it was a really good excuse. Okay, I got to trial this recipe before I talk about it on the radio. So I made them, and oh my goodness, you forget M&Ms if you do something like this, and it's not that hard. So basically I'm going to walk you through her chocolate meringue. I mean, you can make regular meringues too, but this is a chocolate one, which is like, oh boy. So it basically what you're doing is whipping the egg whites, you know, and that sort of thing. Now you set your oven low at 200. Wow. Okay. And then you do have to have a food processor, and you put in 5 ounces of bittersweet or semi-sweet. Now I like as bitter as I can get them, you know, like up to 70% chocolate. Right. She, of course, like all conventional chefs, buys it by the block and chops it up. I'm really, really lazy. I just buy chocolate chips. Then you don't have to chop the stuff up. So anyway, you measure out 5 ounces of bittersweet chocolate chips. And then you're using, for the whole recipe, 2/3 cup of sugar. So I put in about half of that in with the chocolate, right? And then here's what I did. For meringues, you want really fine sugar. So if you have extra fine, use it. If you don't, I put all of my sugar into the food processor and whizzed it till it was really much finer. Then I took some of it out and added the chocolate chips. Okay. That you just put that aside. Then with your mixer, and I just use my hand mixer. You take 3 large egg whites at room temperature. So I had my eggs out for a few hours before so that they were at room temperature. The thing is, when you crack the eggs, you can't get any yolk in the eggs, right? So if you get it a little, fish it out with a broken eggshell or something. So it's straight egg whites. Okay. Then 1/8 teaspoon of cream of tartar. Now, I have a box of cream of tartar that I've had for about 25 years. It just sits there for these occasions, and it is a necessary thing, and it never goes bad. Mm-hmm. So cream of tartar is actually an acidifying agent that is made from something in the grape skins or something like that.
I figured it was one of those mystery ingredients.
No, it's not that. It's tartaric acid or something like that. Okay. Like you can make various cleaning products. You can polish metal with it. You can clean, you know, if you mix it with like baking soda or other things anyway. So, but it only takes a tiny little bit, and 1/8 teaspoon of salt. So you whip the egg whites, and this is the trick. Whip them. Well, there's 2 tricks. First of all, never do this on a day when it's raining. Okay. You really need low humidity, but you whip those egg whites really, really stiff. So you just kind of keep going past, because it's not like whipped cream. It is not going to turn into butter. You just keep whipping till they get really, really stiff and shiny. And then when they're stiff and shiny, or as they're getting towards the end of it, you add in the sugar that you did not mix with the cocoa, right? And keep it whipping till it's really incorporated. Then you turn off the electric mixer, and with a spatula, you fold in your chocolate and sugar mixture into the egg whites. Then you've got your baking pan ready, with parchment. If you have to do something, I used my Silpat, which is that silicone baking thing. But if you don't have one of those, definitely use parchment because they are very sticky. And you got 2 options. I liked the homemade look. So I just plopped sort of roughly 3 to 4 inch circles of meringue. So I had
cookie size,
kind of cookie size, right? But if you want to, if you want your meringues to look like they just came from the Parisian pastry store, right? You take your piping bag with a 7/16 to 3 inch plain tip, which she calls an Azteco number 5, but something like that. And you, starting in the center, you make a circle going out till you've made it the size that you want. But that's optional. I mean, it would be very pretty. But then after that, you put them in the oven that's been reached 200 degrees for 3 hours. So you just like walk away and forget about them. Then at the 3 hour mark, you turn the oven off, but you leave them in there. If you have an electric oven, you might want to crack the door, but with a gas oven, which most of us probably have, you just leave them in there so they cool while the oven is cooling. This like continues to dry them out. And then you take them out, you put them in an airtight container, and they keep for a week or two, something like that. And Lana, tell us what they tasted like.
They are heavenly, crunchy. I've never had a meringue that was chocolate like this. This is really good.
It has a slight gooey in the inside.
Slightly gooey.
Yeah.
But you think, oh, this is a light, wonderful thing. And by the end, it is so sweet and lovely. It what a nice thing for your Valentine's.
Meringue is very sweet. Oh, I did change one thing. I put a tiny bit of canela or Mexican cinnamon. Not too much, so they didn't taste distinctly cinnamon, but just a little bit. The other thing you can do before, and that was into the batter, right? The other thing you can do before you put them in the oven, once you form them on the baking sheet, and this is optional, but I did it. I sprinkled a little unsweetened cocoa powder through a sieve. So it was just like lightly powdered chocolate on the top of it. Mm-hmm. And since the meringue is so sweet, a little more bitter chocolate helps.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
What a treat. What a treat.
I can't tell you how easy this is.
But you just have to plan for a long drying time. Meringues have always been, I've been very intimidated by when they say make a meringue, and oh my goodness, I say, I don't know. But now that I know, I just have to be patient.
It's much easier than you think. Just remember 5 ounces of chocolate, total 2/3 cup of sugar. And you can reduce that a little bit, which I did. 3 large egg whites, 1/8 teaspoon of cream of tartar, 1/8 teaspoon of salt. And then you can put the cocoa powder on top. That's optional.
Ah,
so.
Yum. So.
That's something that would be easy to make that will, believe me, if, instead of giving a box of chocolates, if you give these to somebody, they will be your sweetheart.
Ooh.
We guarantee it.
Yeah. Are there other flavors that you could do?
You could do anything you want to the meringues. Like I didn't work on it, but you could put ground nuts in. You know, you don't want it too heavy because you're going to deflate the meringues. But I was thinking of maybe doing a chestnut version or any kind of nut version. I'll let you know about the how to do that. There also are Nigella Lawson has something she calls a Christmas pavlova, but I think it would be divine for Valentine's Day instead of strawberries, because we're going for pink, right, or red for Valentine's, to use pomegranates.
Ooh!
So Nigella, in her book How to Be a Domestic Goddess,
she's
always very clever, right? So it's the usual egg white thing. Hers is similar. Hers is 8 large egg whites, because this is a bigger recipe. Pinch of salt, 1 2/3 cup sugar. She puts in 1 tablespoon of cornstarch and 1 teaspoon of vinegar. Oh. So the vinegar is instead of the cream of tartar. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you could, you know, like even look up any old meringue mm-hmm. recipe, and you just make them, I would say probably, she says, an 8-inch circle. So like you could take your parchment paper and draw out some circles. You want them a little bigger than the chocolate ones that I made. Then, oh, and she puts 1 teaspoon of rose water in them.
Oh, alrighty.
Yeah. But you could follow hers is put in the oven and reduce. Yeah. And you start out the oven hotter, 350. But when you put them in, she turns it down to 300 and only cooks them for 1 3/4 hours. Then she does the same thing with letting them cool in the oven. That's kind of universal. I think to be safe, I would, you know, I like the 200 degree cook them for 3 hours. It seemed really fail proof. Anyway, so to make the pavlova, what you're doing is you're making the meringues, not chocolate, although you could make chocolate. Why not? Mm-hmm. Then she makes a pomegranate sauce. So she takes a fresh pomegranate and makes juice out of half of it. You could also buy pomegranate juice. And she reduces the pomegranate in a pan and adds lemon juice to the pomegranate juice. And then she whips heavy cream. She makes whipped cream unsweetened. Yeah. Because the pavlova is really, the meringue itself is sweetened. So you've got the baked pavlova. You put on some fairly stiff, but not beaten to butter, whipped cream. And then you sprinkle some of the pomegranate seeds on top of it. And she says to make the pavlova is about 1 inch thick and then to put about 1 inch of whipped cream on it, right? Decadent, right? Uh-huh. But easy to do. Yeah. Then you drizzle it with some pomegranate seeds and it makes a little pink splashy things in the whipped cream. And then once you've put the seeds on, then you obviously you've let the pomegranate syrup come to room temperature and then you just kind of drizzle some over to make a little more pinky red kind of. Now this, you can cook the meringues in advance. You can make the whipped cream in advance. You can make the syrup in advance. But once you put the things together, you have to serve it immediately because of course the whipped cream will melt into the meringue, but that does sound like a really wonderful for a really marvelous romantic Valentine's Day dinner.
Oh, Donna, you have outdone yourself. And we have pink too. We have pink.
Yeah, instead of strawberries, pomegranates.
Do we have good ideas or what? Oh, I want to take this opportunity to say this is KHOI and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Are you getting in the mood for some sweets for Valentine's Day? Treat yourself. Treat your loved ones. I think meringues sound lovely, but Donna has got more stuff for us.
We're into using egg products for making desserts. So the other recipe that is also, this one is from Nigella Lawson, but there are millions of coconut macaroon recipes, right? Mm-hmm. Hers is, again, you know, egg whites, you beat them. She uses cream of tartar in this, sugar. She puts in ground almonds and a pinch of salt. And then hers call for vanilla extract. But since it's Valentine's Day, it's only a teaspoon. You can't make them too wet. But you could use the concentrated pomegranate to make it pink. Or you could use, you could boil down some cherry juice to make it pink. You could end up with pink coconut macaroons, right? And then, of course, the coconut. And it's the same thing of really whipping the egg whites and then folding in the ground almonds and the coconut and then dropping them onto the baking sheet lined with parchment and then cooking them, you know, at a lower
cook,
heat.
Cook them slow and don't do it on a rainy day.
Yeah, and they're, you know, there's, and she added, I think, rose water in hers, or why not add rose water? With the pink.
Yeah.
You just gotta be careful not to put too much liquid into those egg white recipes, or they will not work.
They will fall down.
But, yeah. And now, the other eggy dish that is one of my all-time favorites since I was a child is cream puffs.
Woohoo!
So, and children love this. Adults, who doesn't love these? You can make them in the eclair shape or the puff shape. And it's also the recipe I have always used, and my mother even used, the joy of cooking. It's called, under, and there it's called cream puff shells. But it's also, if you have another recipe that calls, the French name is pâte à choux, P-A-T-E-A, and then choux, C-H-O-U-X, or pouf paste. So this is a very eggy recipe. The same thing, and it's always funny. You start with the in a heavy saucepan, you add a cup of water and a third of water or milk and a third cup of butter, and you boil that up until all of the butter is melted into the milk, and then you add the flour mixture in one fell swoop, as the joy of cooking says, and stir it quickly with it. It looks really odd. You know, I use a wooden spoon, and you're still over the heat, very low heat, and you beat the flour in to the, you know, until it's kind of, smooth. And then you start dropping in one egg at a time, and you go up, and the eggs have to be at room temperature, the whole egg for this, right? Four or five eggs into this. And you keep adding one egg at a time without letting it, you know, well, you might have to remove the pan from the heat. You don't want to get too cold, but you don't want to burn it at this point. And what you're doing is beating it, and it looks kind of shiny and slick. And then the egg starts to incorporate, and then you add another egg, and you do this till you've done four or five eggs, and you keep beating it. And then the dough is ready. So then it's the same thing with the putting it out on the pastry sheet. You can either blob it out by hand, or, you know, you could use your pastry bag and puff it on, and you could, you know, you can make that long eclair shape, or you can make the round, or you can make little ones. They're called profiteroles if they're little.
Oh, that's where that word comes. I mean, I have...
Well, and profiteroles are
little hand.
But you they always have something vanilla, either whipped cream or ice cream in the middle with chocolate sauce on top.
Profiteroles.
Right, profiteroles. And the marvelous thing about the, don't make them too much in advance. They're better kind of eaten certainly on the day of or in advance. But they're so easy to make, and they're so much fun for children. And then you can fill them with whatever you want, like chocolate pudding or vanilla pudding with chocolate sauce dribbled over it. Or even, you know, you can buy ice cream and put it in, or even yogurt, or, you know, I mean, whatever is your favorite thing. I'm a big pudding fan, so I like to put, you know, the pastry cream kind of stuff in them. And they are just magical. It always takes me back to my childhood, because my mother and I did not bake and cook a lot. She was a professional woman, but this is one thing we did. And as a really young child, one of my first library memories is mother always took us to the library, and we would get the Raggedy Ann and Andy books. And there is one with Betsy Bonnet String, who has a magic apron. And when she shakes the apron, the cream puffs come out. So.
Now, is that a good memory or what?
Oh, it's one of probably the earliest things I can remember. It was so impressive. So bake cream puffs for your children.
Oh.
It's a big memory thing.
Oh,
it's impressive for children.
And again, Donna suggests a good recipe is from The Joy of Cooking. As so many are.
And
so.
It is an odd recipe. You think this can't be right. This is a very weird dough, but it just works so nicely.
It works. Oh, good. Good. Profiteroles. Oh, see, word of the day, profiteroles. Little cream puffs. Very good.
Yes, and now we get to a little more chocolate for Valentine's. Well, Lana has a cake recipe. Right.
I have a favorite cake, and I used to make this quite a bit, and it's a fuss, but it's worth it. It's called Emperor's Chocolate Walnut Cake, and it also celebrates the egg, because this is from a book called Fabulous and Flourless. It has no flour. By the author Mary Wachtel Mauksch, Mauksch. Emperor's Chocolate Walnut Cake. This is what it says about it. If gods had ever tasted this cake, they would have forsaken ambrosia for it. Although somewhat lower on the divinity scale, the emperors of Austria and Hungary pervert it to all other desserts. And because this is a... there's a lot of these older, especially Northern European recipes, but European in general, that don't have flour in them. Flour was not really all that ubiquitous until later, when the trade routes were opened up. And so nut flours were a big deal. And this has walnuts, ground walnuts, and actually quite a few, one and two-thirds cup ground walnuts instead of flour.
See? So you're supposed to grind them yourself, right?
Yep, grind.
I would recommend just doing I've been doing this lately when I'm doing nuts in I roast them a little bit first, like either in a dry skillet or in a dry pan in the oven and turning them a little bit. You don't burn them, and you can do it quick, like no more than 10 minutes, and watch them. Mm-hmm. But toast them and then grind them yourself, and it will be delicious.
Yes. So the walnuts are here instead of.
How many walnuts?
1 2/3 cups.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's real serious walnut flour. Okay. I bet you could use hazelnut flour.
I think you could use any hazelnut. Yeah. Okay, this is in a springform pan. What a good invention, a springform pan, the kind that you can take the bottom out of after you
For delicate cakes, it's really important.
Good. And
you got to get it out of the pan in one piece.
And grease and flour that so you're all ready to go. There's 5 ounces of bittersweet chocolate, 5 tablespoons of butter, 6 large eggs, 3/4 cups sugar, 1/4 teaspoon freshly squeezed lemon juice, and then 1 2/3 cup of those ground walnuts.
That's quite a lot of eggs in there.
So you melt chocolate, cut the butter into the chocolate, and then in a small bowl, beat the egg yolks and sugar until creamy. Mm-hmm. And then add the chocolate mixture. And then in a separate bowl, beat the egg whites with a little lemon juice until firm and creamy. So again, we're looking for a kind of firm.
So both the almonds and the chocolate separately have been ground, though.
The chocolate is melted into the butter.
Okay.
And then you combine those two gently, the beaten egg whites. And this little lemon,
folding is important. Folding. With egg whites, folding means, you're not like, you're just gently kind of flipping them into the batter until they incorporate, usually with a spatula.
A nice big spatula, sort of encouraging a happy union between all of
right.
this.
Right, you don't want
to keep the air
keep
in.
The daylights
keep
out
keep
of it.
Keep the air in, yes. And then put it in the springform pan and bake in the center of a preheated oven. At 350 for 40 minutes. And then you remove the cake from the springform pan and set it on a wire rack to cool. And now this cake is lovely anyway, because it's got chocolate in it. It's rich. And it's lovely.
Now, when you're cooling, do you leave the bottom on the springform pan until it's cool, or do you take it off at that point?
No, I leave it on.
On the bottom,
I'm very leery of, I want to make sure this whole thing is cooled and kind of
set. And solid enough to take off the pan.
You can spring off the outside after it's cooled a little bit. And that's usually pretty easy, but heck, I've even served it on the bottom because I don't want it to fall apart. There it is. What do they care? Okay, now this is what kind of makes it really pretty. You make a basic chocolate glaze. I think you'd call it a ganache. It's a chocolate frosting. But that goes on top, but you put a layer in between. To make this a layer cake, you want to cut your cake
horizontally, like with a big bread knife.
Or
another way,
use a string or a piece of dental floss.
Oh,
what a good way, especially with a real rich cake like this. You want to cut it horizontally, and then you can use a big spatula, or probably two, lift the top off gently, and then on that center part, it suggests 1 cup of currant jelly, or whatever, some kind of good jelly, but currant jelly. Spread that, put the chocolate cake
something tart, sweet and tart, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then drizzle chocolate glaze over the top of it. I think that's
a drizzle over the top.
It's a drizzle. It's a drizzle. You know, it drizzles so it looks
fancy.
So fancy.
Yeah.
But this Emperor's chocolate walnut cake, you know, you're flipping through a cookbook and you think, oh, that's a bit of fuss, and I don't know if I could ever do that, but it's not bad at all once you've gone through and done all the bits. And if you want to do something fancy for Valentine's Day, adding a little jelly as your or jam as your center layer.
Ooh, I think I'd like cherry jelly.
That'd be good too. See, everybody to his own. Mm-hmm. That is good. So we are having a good time talking about
that. Yeah, that recipe reminds me a little bit of another. It's a chocolate souffle that I used to make a lot for my clients. It's from another Alice Medridge book called Chocolate and the Art of Low-Fat Desserts. Now, when I had all my Hollywood clients, particularly at that time, everybody was going through a no fat, you know, and everybody, of course, still wanted their dessert, but they didn't want fat. So I invented biscottis that had no fat. And this chocolate souffle it's got egg yolks in it, but because it's mostly egg whites, you know, egg whites and meringues don't have any fat in them. Sugar, lots of sugar, but so I use this chocolate souffle recipe for a lot, and I made them in the individual like baking cups, right? So that way I had for dinner parties, I could take them all out of the oven and put one on each platter. Now there are two options. If you serve them right out of the oven and they're all puffy like a souffle, that's pretty. Or you can take them out and let them fall, and then it's like a fallen chocolate cake. And her recipe, 5 teaspoons of sugar, 1 cup of powdered sugar, 1/2 cup of unsweetened Dutch processed cocoa, 2 tablespoons of flour, 1/2 cup low-fat milk, 4 egg whites at room temperature. There's the cream of tartar again, 1/8 teaspoon. 3 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon of granulated sugar, egg yolks. So basically what you're doing is you make the mixture with like the cocoa, the sugar, et cetera, and first you have to powder the containers, the little individual ramekins, so that the souffle does not.
So
it kind of rises up.
Grease and powder.
You sugar the cups. You pour a little granulated sugar in the souffle cup and tilt it to coat the bottoms. You spray them with vegetable oil. Ooh. Then you put the sugar in and kind of, you know, like you roll around to put flour in the pan till they're all covered. Then you sift the powdered sugar, the cocoa, and the flour into the top of a double boiler. You add the milk and water and you whisk until it's smooth, and you cook, you know, kind of getting it to all emulsify until it's thickened about 10 minutes. Then you put that aside and let it cool because you don't want to mix it in hot. You beat the egg whites with a cream of tartar and you gradually sprinkle in the sugar and you make it stiff. And then you whisk the egg yolks and the vanilla into the chocolate mixture that you've made. And you fold about 1/4 of the egg whites into the chocolate mixture to lighten it. And then you keep folding once again the remaining whites, and then you divide the mixture between the different souffle cups, and you could fill it up to about 1/4 inch below the rims because you want it to pop up over the top of the dish, right? Then you put them in the baking sheet, and you only bake them for 15 to 17 minutes. And that was it. What was the temperature? 350. Okay. Yeah. So you want to do this kind of at the last minute. Then you serve them with a little powdered sugar over the top. And, oh, and she does say, do not overbake. Remember, there's no fat in there. You serve with a little powdered sugar, or you can dollop with just a little bit of, if they're cold, you can put the whipped cream on them.
Ooh.
Unsweetened, preferably.
So we've got things for your Valentine, no matter what, even if you want no fat.
Yeah, the chocolate souffle is the, if you're counting calories, that's a good one to go with.
Isn't that a good idea? You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. For more information, you can go to khoyfm.org. You can find a webpage about us there and all kinds of recipes, past shows. Oh, yes. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I mentioned there's a recipe page on the KHOI website under the Donna Lana Kitchen Show. And you might find some inspirations for Valentine's Day there. Yes.
There's some chocolatey things in there.
There's some chocolatey things. And there's an oatmeal cutout cookie recipe. That doesn't look like Valentine's Day. But I've used a heart to cut out that oatmeal cutout cookies. And
another good project for children.
Yeah.
And you could add a little beet juice or something pink to color them pink.
Or make some drizzly
pink
drizzly
frosting.
Yeah. There's good stuff on that website. Yes, there's also a chocolate Linzer torte, which comes from that same flourless and fabulous cookbook I talked about earlier. Chocolate Linzer torte, which is another good use of good sweet pastry and a jam or a jelly in infusion there. Yes, good.
Yeah, so we're encouraging you to... Not buy the conventional stuff, or if you're going to buy the conventional stuff, also make some homemade things.
Yeah.
And have a do-it-yourself Valentine's Day, the non-commercial variety.
Yeah, I mean, I like M&Ms too, but I think Donna's meringues are, I can speak from experience.
Okay, remember that old advertising slogan, nothing says loving like something from the oven?
Yes, that's it.
That's right. Oh. Nothing says loving like something from the oven.
It was a little commercial break there. But yeah, we suggest that. Not only can you do it from your heart, but you can involve other people too. And
I used to know this Native American who would say that love is a verb. It means you do something. You know, you just don't go out and spend money. You do something.
Right. Yeah. People spend a whole lot of money on Valentine's things, and well, that's got its charms too. But oh, speaking of Valentine's Day this year, news item I saw in a number of places that, of course, I suppose this has to do with all those containers stuck on the shores and not being able to get here. Roses are in short supply.
Oh.
No, for goodness sakes, you're just going to have to make yourself a meringue instead, I think. Roses come from a lot of roses come from
Central and South America.
Central and
don't
South
they?
America, yeah. So not only does it take a lot of, carbon-intensive stuff to get those suckers here, but
And there's questions about labor abuse in those places.
So when you're giving a rose, give some thought to a rose. Yes.
A rose-colored something.
Yeah.
Pavlova or
pavlova.
Or chocolate.
Or chocolate. That's good. So, we've got a few upcoming things happening here. For one thing, we've got some shows kind of in the works for you coming up later this spring, and you're just going to have to tune in and find out about it. We do want to always remind you that we do things that are of interest to local food consumers and local food eaters and local food growers. So we'll be talking about right here in the center of the country, all those good stuffs. What's cooking?
What's seasonal and what's local?
What's seasonal and what is cooking? So there are some also some upcoming things that are happening. I got a note from Alice McGarry at Mustard Seed Farm north of Ames, and she sends out news of events happening. And tomorrow, February 9th, 2022, at 6 p.m., there is going to be a live stream presentation presented by Iowa State University featuring Winona LaDuc. Winona LaDuc is an environmental activist, author, two-time former Green Party vice presidential candidate, and she lives on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. She does a lot of good things. She is going to be speaking on seed sovereignty. Who owns the seeds of the world? Biopiracy, genetic engineering, and indigenous people. Winona LaDuc talking about seed sovereignty. Go to Iowa State University and look up this event.
Is that like under their speakers forum or something like that? Yeah. You can find it that way? Okay.
There is a link through that. That's good.
Oh, yes. It's what's it called? The George Hegstrom Symposium.
Oh, that's another thing.
Oh, that's in. Oh, sorry. Sorry.
But that's okay.
Okay, so we can find this on the ISU website. It's for tomorrow night.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, also, there is at Ryman Gardens this weekend, thinking of things to do that are spring-like and pretty, there is an orchid show Saturday and Sunday. Oh, orchids. I've never understood orchids. They seem a bit overblown to me, but they are so lovely. So anyway, Ryman Gardens in their greenhouses. An orchid show. And also, the Practical Farmers of Iowa are giving an apple growers workshop Friday, February the 11th, 2002 at Ryman Gardens on Iowa State campus. And focusing on commercial scale apple production. Huh? So there's going to be a lot of interesting things said about apple production in the Midwest. Hear speakers from around the Midwest, and it's one of those practical farmers learn from the pros, but also learn from each other, because that's what happens there. Yes.
Farmers helping farmers.
Right. So practical farmers, you can go to info@practicalfarmers.org or phone number 515-232-5661. I want to thank everyone for joining us today and also remind you that this is community radio. Community radio gets by with your help. We are not owned by a large corporation. We are owned by a large group of people, which means your friends and neighbors. If we are in your ears right now, consider putting us in your heart. Go to the KHOR website, khorfm.org, and find out about becoming a member and supporting this fine radio station. You've been listening to The Dunnell in a Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday live at noon, but you can find out more at that fine website. Go to KHOR website and stream us live or find old shows. We had good stuff to say today about Valentine's Day.
Right, and we hope that you feel motivated to go and make your own Valentine's goodie.
Yeah, sounds good to me. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.